Who can say where the killer roams? When the blood flows, it's slaying time. Slay away. Slay away. Slay away.
Where we discuss the inspiration behind your favorite horror films, lore, gore, and every kill in between. I'm your host, E.L. King, and on this very special episode of Slay Away, we're chatting with Luke Boyce, director of the Shudder original apocalyptic supernatural neon horror Revealer. The dark comedy is Boyce's feature debut. He collaborated on the story with Hack/ series creator and writer Tim Seeley and comics author Michael Morisi. The film stars Cato Acey, Shayna Shrutin, and Bishop Stevens. Revealer follows an exotic dancer, Angie Pitarelli, played by Acey, in 1987 Chicago. Angie works the peep show booth at the Revealer's bookstore, and after her boss, Ray, played by Bishop Stevens, is killed in the chaos erupting outside, cue the rapture, Angie becomes trapped inside the cubicle next to a religious zealot who's hiding out. In the age of sin and satanic panic, she's essentially the low-rent Tammy Faye, one venomous Sally Mewborn, played by Shayna Shrutin. The two must work together to escape the evil that's come to claim all the sinners.
Men and women turning on each other, tearing each other's skin with their teeth and their nails. Eyes like snakes. Screams from below, cries from above. It's the end of the world. Judgment comes to wipe your stain from the world.
Trust me, Sals. Stain's coming out of my booth, ain't from me.
So gross! It is the hour of our reckoning, and I have to spend it with you?
I like what I do. I don't like being shamed for it, especially by the one person who is so hot to save my soul, but can't be bothered to save me from dying in a fucking peep show booth! Messed up shit do I have to deal with in a single day?
Maybe try to be a little less aggressive. You've been scaring the customers.
I am super excited to kick off this interview and have Luke Boyce here around the campfire with me. Luke, thank you so much for being here. Welcome. I'm really glad that I could put out a shout into the void that is Twitter, and you replied back.
Well, thank you. I'm very excited.
Obviously, we love Shudder, and I know you're a big fan as well.
Yes.
Revealer premiered on Shudder just this last week, and the film is fantastic. I had a great time watching it. It was not exactly what I expected it to be, but in the best ways possible. So
thank you so much. Your review was incredible. It just made my day.
So interestingly enough, I think I've been acquainted with Tim for quite some time. I met him at Emerald City Comic Con in Seattle. Oh my gosh, at least a decade and a half ago. So I knew that I was going to want to devour Revealer right away once I found out that he had collaborated on writing the story and the screenplay. So
nice.
So let's talk about horror, my favorite subject. Tell me how you discovered your love of horror.
Oh yeah, huge love of horror. You know, my horror history is kind of, it's interesting. I wasn't one of those people who just sort of like absolutely devoured it as a kid. I got scared easily fairly early. So it took me a while, partly because I remember seeing a commercial when I was really little for Child's Play. And we had a My Buddy doll at home. And it just like hit my brain so hard, this idea of this doll coming to life, that I just thought, no, I can't do this. This is too scary. I had a very, very traumatizing experience just from a commercial from that movie. And it actually took me, I didn't watch any of the Child's Play movies because of that until I think maybe 3 years ago, probably, which funny enough, like now it's like one of my favorite franchises. I probably could have done it a lot earlier, but I was scared pretty easy as a kid. But at the same time, I've been obsessed with movies since it's one of the first things I can ever remember. It's like honestly one of my only childhood memories that is just so clear to me is how much I love movies. I've wanted to be a filmmaker since I was, God, it's one of my earliest memories is wanting to be a filmmaker. So, you know, and early on, I was like really into a lot of, I was really into a lot of old movies because I grew up in a very evangelical household, very evangelical. And so, you know, we consumed secular media for sure. I mean, we had television, that wasn't a problem, but not much. My parents were pretty strict about what I watched. So, you know, I kind of had a really early love of like old music and old movies because it was just safer, you know, for my parents. So yeah, like one of my earliest memories is just falling in love with, you know, the original Lugosi Dracula and all the Universal monsters. And I used to watch a lot of old horror on TV. You know, I remember one of my favorite things was, I don't know if you remember this, but TNT before MonsterVision had this thing called 100% Weird.
Oh, gosh. I don't know if I remember it specifically, but I know what you're talking about.
Oh, my God. I watched this thing. So I actually got into MonsterVision specifically because it kind of came after 100% Weird. And I was obsessed with 100% Weird. And you know, they would show a lot of just weird old horror. So that was kind of my first foray. When I was a teenager, I remember a friend of mine, one of my first things, we watched all the Friday the 13th movies like in one night. There was a marathon on TV.
All of them? Well, okay. What year was this?
It was television, so they probably skipped 5 or 4 or something like that. I think it was like maybe 6 of them in a night. But you know, it was kind of my first real, that's where I think I was like, oh, I kind of understand. I kind of get this. Like this is
your
super
foray
fun
into the slasher genre as well.
Yes. Yeah. And it's such it's an easy genre to get into because the concept.
Oh yeah. It's a gateway drug to horror. So.
Yep. Exactly.
Well, what about filmmaking? Like, I know you said that you had a really strong desire to be a filmmaker from the time that you were a young kid. So how did you end up getting into filmmaking or pursuing that?
So my dad was this kind of struggling artist. He came from a family. We grew up in a really small town. There was like 800 people in my town. So it was very small. My kindergarten through high school was in one building, 20 kids in my class. So I really grew up in a really small Midwestern town. There, my family had kind of, my dad's family had like this electrical dynasty. And then my mom's family had an air conditioning and heating dynasty. And they were like, it was a very interesting time. And so like the whole family were these blue collar, you know, entrepreneur workers. And my dad decided to pursue, for a while he was like a graphic designer and a sign painter. To kind of be a freelance artist in a really, really small town in the middle of Illinois is tough to do. So, I basically watched him struggle my whole life and he kind of would move from one thing to the other. But he also was just like, he was just into anything artistic. I mean, he loved movies. He loved comics. He loved, you know, we watched a lot of animation, and he had at one point he was a magician and a ventriloquist. So I just was like, really, and I'm the oldest of three boys. So, you know, I just grew up on this. I grew up, you know, in this household that was just very, very artistic. And even though we were evangelical, I mean, even in church, we were always pushing, you know, for artistic endeavors. And so, for some reason, I just sort of like clicked with movies. One of my earliest memories is just playing with this camera that my family had brought on a vacation. And I think that was actually like 1987, which is the same year as the movie. So that's kind of the first time I remember, oh, like this is cool. And I remember getting this Steven Spielberg biography from like our local library, like for kids, and sort of that was the first time I understood what movies were. So I ended up literally the rest of my childhood making movies with friends. I have tons and tons and tons of stuff. That's all I wanted to do. Cause honestly, like my school, it was so small. There weren't a lot of artistic outlets. Like they didn't have programs for kids. Art programs, like I should say. We had an art class, but it wasn't, there wasn't a lot of outlets. So you really had to find your own entertainment. And that was kind of mine. And I wanted to go to film school, but I took a detour right before college and for a lot of college and was actually a singer-songwriter for about 7 years. But I hated performing. I just like, I desperately missed movies. So I decided to I left that whole music business, which is a nightmare, and started a company basically instead of going to film school. I was like, well, I'll just make movies or make some commercial movies and on the side use the equipment that we get from the business to sort of make movies and kind of teach myself and try to work up towards a narrative company. And I met this other guy, Brett, who we became business partners. And that was in 2005. And so I've been kind of just doing a lot of commercial work while we've also been producing constantly and just building up a network of people that we knew, doing tons and tons of movies. We've worked with tons of stuff in Chicago and really just sort of building this Chicago film network over the past 17 years. That's a long-winded sort of my entire film history of getting to this point, I guess.
No. We love long-winded answers here. And that's a really great story. So I wanted to ask you, I saw that you are a fan of comics.
Oh yeah.
Were you familiar with Tim Seeley's work prior to working on Revealer? Because I know that you worked on the story with Tim and Michael.
Yeah, very familiar. So Tim and I have been working on getting a film adaptation of Revival done for a while. So I've been attached to direct that for a bit. The idea was to initially do, we wanted to do Revival as a movie, but we wanted to do it independently. And so we were trying to raise private equity to do it. And that's pretty tough because we realized, well, we don't want to like skimp on this thing. It requires a decent budget. So the problem with that is, you know, it kind of had a lot of ups and downs money-wise. We just couldn't move forward with it as much as we wanted. And there's some cool things happening with it right now. Some really, I'm excited to tell people about, but it's still under wraps.
I want to be the first to know when it's time. Get ready.
Great.
I know, I'm a big fan of Hack Slash, Yeah, so that's how I got into collecting horror comics as well.
Oh, wow, that's awesome.
Through Hackslash.
Nice.
Are you a horror comic collector?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean...
What are some of your favorites? That's what I gotta know.
Oh, gosh. That's a good question. I mean, probably one of my all-time favorite comics. I think it's probably in my top three is Alan Moore's Swamp Thing. And then by, you know, from that, I'm just a huge fan of Hellblazer and a lot of those early Vertigo books. I'm trying to think. And my dad, actually, interestingly enough, so my dad was a comic collector as a kid, and I had a bunch of his stuff. And so I would actually read a lot of the old horror comic magazines, Vault of Horror, or, you know, some of those EC stuff. That was one of my first. So I'm like really into like Bronze Age type gothic horror, you know? Yeah, it's just I really love that stuff. I'm trying to think of any modern. I mean, I love Hackslash, obviously. I mean, all of Tim's stuff is great.
I have a collection of Hackslash, and I recently wrote another review for The Sadness because I was a collector of Crossed.
Nice.
Which is probably one of the more fucked up horror books out there. But I honestly never thought they'd be able to adapt anything like that into a film. But I mean, with just this topic of being on comics, like I was super excited. I saw that Vault is doing a tie-in book
for Revealer, and that will be coming out in August.
Yeah.
And I already pre-ordered it. So
it might be August 3rd, actually. I don't know.
Oh, really? Like, it said 31st on the article I read in the site, but if it's sooner, that's amazing.
I hope it's sooner. We were told it was August 3rd, but maybe it got pushed. I don't know. Hopefully it's August 3rd.
Okay, well, maybe. We'll just let people know. August, look out for the tie-in Revealer comic.
Our hope... We're really hoping. So I think I can make this announcement now, but we're going to be doing a special Revealer screening at C2E2, Chicago Comic Con. And that's on August 5th, I believe. Our goal was to have the comic available by C2E2. So,
okay.
So I'm hoping that that's the case. I gotta clarify for sure, but regardless, August. Yeah, it will definitely be
August.
Yes.
Well, with that, tell everyone about Revealer.
So Revealer,
give us the sell. What's the sales pitch?
Yeah. Well, it's actually great. That's like Tim is an amazing at high concept pitches. So Revealer is about a stripper and a religious protester in the 80s in Chicago. And Angie is the name of the stripper. And she's most days has to go to work and deal with this Christian protester, this decency league that protests outside of her store. And this particular day that the movie takes place on, it just so happens that the rapture happens and the apocalypse starts. And Angie gets stuck in her peep show booth with the religious protester who's hiding out from the horrors outside. And they basically have to find a way to escape the adult bookstore. And they do so through an interesting means of going below. But yeah, it's mostly just a character piece. It's a small film. There's only really a couple locations. So, you know, the whole thing really is just kind of dealing with these two characters having to learn how to work together despite being complete opposites and kind of hating each other. But that experience sort of starts to peel away layers of who they are, both good and bad. And, you know, much is revealed, essentially.
True.
So this film was shot during the pandemic in 2020. The characters and their dialogue, were they always meant to carry the film, or is that something that came about because of the time period in which it was being filmed?
So this kind of goes perfectly to my story about kind of knowing Tim. We were, you know, been working on Revival, and the pandemic happened. Revival was supposed to get started, and you know, we had the pandemic and just a lot of stuff fell through. So those first 2 or 3 months of the quarantine in 2020, it just sort of hit us like a ton of bricks. And there's several of us, me and my producer, Sarah Sharp, my partner, producing partner, Brett, and Tim and Michael Morisi, who is also a writer, co-writer on the script. We got very antsy and we said, listen, all these movies everyone had done are getting canceled. So is there a world where we could write a script quick and make a movie during the quarantine, but make it in a way that, you know, we can protect the actors essentially who can't wear masks. You know, we were kind of saying like, we don't want to make a Zoom movie. Like we don't want to make a pandemic movie or a movie that's about the pandemic specifically. So the cool thing with Tim and Mike being comic writers is that I had been pushing this idea that part of what they do is like they'll take a concept with all these parameters, whether it's like for a DC comic or a Marvel comic or whatever, and they'll whip a story up and write it in a week. I mean, they're just really good at that. They're trained to do that. So literally this idea came to Tim and he had an idea within a night. I mean, he came up with this concept in a day and pitched it to everyone. And they're like, this is fantastic. Let's do this. Because the whole thing was like, yeah, if they're stuck in a peep show booth, like not only is it two people for the majority of it, but they have to talk through a wall. You know, there's actual barrier there between them. Which obviously in the movie that only keeps them apart for a small amount of time.
Yes, but looking at this film, it doesn't look like a pandemic film. It does not look like it was shot during the pandemic at all.
Thank you. That's
good. It's that's like high studio quality work.
Oh, wow. Thank you.
And I was like, oh, yeah, this is, you know, but it's just my kind of movie that I would want to go watch. And I noticed there's a part of the film where Angie is in one location and then Sally is on the other side of the wall. And then Sally needs to go and do something. Mm-hmm. And Ray, in after the apocalypse has started, we'll just say, comes over to the window of the booth, and then you still only have two people in one place because right. of the way that this setup is. And I was like, oh, that was so ingenious. After I found out that it was a pandemic film. So
it's fun. It's fun to work in those. Yeah, it's almost like, you know, it's sort of like filmmaking is problem solving, you know, that's all it is. And sometimes those limitations and those parameters can kind of breed interesting scenarios. And that was kind of like, that was sort of the whole thing was sort of an exercise in trying to do that, to see how we could do that. And, you know, and even when there is like later on, when there's a third person involved, again, they're in a mask. So, you know, you want to make something that still works. You want to make something that's still good. But, you know, the whole thing was sort of an exercise to see, okay, can we do this? How can we do this? And yeah, we had no issues. I mean, our budget was so low. And I think a lot of people would be surprised at how low our budget was. But it was so low. And we filmed in, I think, 12 to 13 days. If one person had gotten COVID, the movie would have been done. We would have been shut down because our crew was so small. We had people doing multiple jobs at once. And the whole thing was just to keep it bubbled. I mean, nobody was allowed to essentially leave. I mean, we were either quarantined in our hotel or on the set the whole time. So, you know, but it was, again, this was early quarantine. We were fine with it. Like everybody wanted to work. We were all excited to work. And that was part of the sort of joy of making this and then making something that we also all felt was really fun.
Well, and I have to say that I was very impressed with the performances from the lead actors. Kato and Shayna just knocked it absolutely out of the park. Not only the relationship between these two characters, but just individually their performances throughout the film. It was so authentic and sincere. And, you know, beyond that, just their physicality as well. They really brought these two characters to life and I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I could go on all day about them. Not only are they just the two most wonderful people I've ever met, they're just so goddamn good. And there's just so much they have to do in this film. I mean, to begin with, like with Angie, when I was looking at, so basically they came to me through a casting director Sarah Casey of Compass Casting. And we got a ton of auditions because, again, actors were also wanting to work. But we were trying to keep the film small and off the radar. So we couldn't do SAG or anything like that. So, you know, we were getting actors from Chicago and, you know, not going SAG, you're not sure how good level of quality of actors you're going to get. But right away, like, I saw the auditions of both of these girls and it was just like, they blew me away. And you know how, like, as a Hackslash fan, you probably know, like, Tim writes this specific kind of person, you know, his girls always kind of have this sort of edge to them and they have this way of speaking. And I kind of knew, like, Angie's sort of the same way. And
she's very quick-witted, very sharp.
Quick-witted. And she
very
has
funny.
Yes, very funny. And it's like, it's actually hard. It's hard to, Tim's dialogue is so specific, that it was surprising to see a lot of people couldn't quite catch the cadence of the Tim talk, I guess you could say. And Kato, like, one of the reasons I cast her is because she just nailed it right away. She was able to just, she talked the way I imagined a Tim girl would talk, the way I imagined a Cassie Hack or a Dana Cypress or someone like that, you know, would talk in all his other books. So that was a big thing for me. But then also just, like, not just quick-witted, but the film is, you know, it's unabashedly earnest. It's it kind of wears its heart on its sleeve. It's not ambiguous in any way. You know, it is a very kind of, it's a morality tale. And, you know, we needed two people who could sell that as well. And then, like, Shayna's sitting here going, you know, she has to be this sort of, like, hateful person that
very
also
repressed.
Manages, yes, but, like, she's got to also manage to sort of win you over a little bit, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you got to be like, and that was actually tough. I mean, there was most of our auditions were people who were either really good at one version or really good at the other version. Shayna was one of the only ones who could really deliver this sort of, like, you know, shrill, annoying Christian and then still sort of have that thing about them where, you know, you can kind of
relate
latch
to them.
Onto,
I could
yeah.
relate. I could relate to, in some ways, I could relate to Shayna. At least in that time period,
yeah.
there was a lot going on with her character and things about her character in the 80s that would have made it even more difficult than I think now. But
yeah.
And this is me not talking directly about it, so I don't give it away.
It's hard to not talk spoilers.
But, it's, you know, I felt that, and mm-hmm. you could really come along with her and really feel for her, especially in those ending points of the film.
Yeah.
And the way that Angie then receives that, I think, at first was frustration, and then understanding,
yeah.
So she sold it as well. So I have to talk about, if I don't talk about this scene, which we're going to give a little bit away, but if I don't talk about this scene, I will regret it. So there is this amazing montage within the first act of
oh, yes.
the film. And it's, I absolutely love it. And it sort of gives you some insight into both of these characters and their personalities. You see Angie dancing for the first time and really owning her body and who she is and her personality, and you sort of learn so much about her in those scenes. There's no shame coming from her. There's mm-hmm. none of that essentially Sally is trying to make her feel about who she is. Where on the flip side, we see Sally outside, just, you see the hatefulness and the rage and the anger all over her face,
mm-hmm.
Shouting with the protesters. And this scene in particular, what really sold it for me, as I told you, the title track from Dark All Day came on from
yeah.
Gunship, from their 2018 album. And I love Gunship.
Me too.
Immediately I knew what the song was and I was like, oh my God, is that Dark All Day? I went and I checked. I was like, it is Dark All Day. And I was replaying it on Spotify and then playing it in the film and just like double checking. And I was like, oh, and it's so perfect. It's such the perfect track for that montage, especially for Angie's dance.
Yeah.
And I love that it's her that puts in the cassette tape And this is her music, right? Yeah. And then I think someone makes a comment about, well, if you didn't play that
Dennis Trill music,
yeah, you'd have more people coming in to watch you or something like that. And I just thought it was great. So let's talk about that scene and let's talk about Gunship a little bit.
Yeah, hell yeah. Well, so to start, the original script sort of had that. I mean, it did sort of have this sort of montage dance scene in it. So we knew that was going to be there, but it was a little more... scripted version is a little bit more rough around the edges. It was featuring more, like, the music in the film was supposed to be more period punk. You know, with such a small budget, we weren't really sure if we were going to be able to have any actual needle drops like that. But right away, both Tim and I are a huge Gunship fans.
I'm so glad we all have that in common.
Yes. Well, and it's so cool because it's like Gunship is this band that's, for the people that know them, they're huge, but they're still not quite, you know, they still haven't like fully broken through. So we kind of knew like, oh man, this would just be a really great way to, you know, expose a lot of horror fans to this band who I think are, you know, especially from the horror genre. I mean, if you've seen their videos and stuff, these guys are massive, massive fans. I mean, Dark All Day itself is an homage to The Lost Boys.
Which is one of my favorite films, also from 1987.
Exactly.
So it's just like this perfect marriage.
Yeah, right, it's one of the reasons we set the movie in 1987, just because we love so many of those movies in 1987. I love The Lost
Boys. One of my favorites. Same. So
yeah,
it makes sense. And this did kind of give me a little bit of a lot of Gunship's music brings me back to some of the tracks from The Lost Boys for that soundtrack.
Yeah.
And you definitely get some of those vibes from obviously the very jazz influenced songs that are on The Lost Boys soundtrack and then what comes into what is essentially retro wave or synth wave now.
Well, and actually, so I'm a huge synth wave fan.
Me too.
And yeah, so I like it's almost all I listen to now. But I love how synthwave as a genre, basically, it's not inspired by like actual music of the 80s. It's inspired by movie music and video games of the 80s. So it's like really kind of like, it's trying to evoke a nostalgic feeling, but you can't quite take a lot of synthwave bands and then connect them to just like throwback music, where a lot of throwback music is like really, you know, it's throwback to a specific music genre. And since we were kind of making a film that was sort of an alternate reality kind of film, you know, a film where the apocalypse happens in 1987, and we didn't have this budget to do a ton of like 80s needle drops. And honestly, I was reluctant to even, when you get movies, 80s movies, you know, that, and don't get me wrong, I absolutely love Stranger Things. This last season was incredible. But, you know, that's a big thing, is all these 80s needle drops telling you this is the 80s. I thought it would be cool to do music that sort of evoked the 80s. That wasn't, that sounds like the 80s, but it's not like recognizable as an 80s, you know, hit essentially. And Gunship was perfect for that, because not only do they do that, and especially this track, but they, you know, they also sort of have this horror cred as well. Like a lot of their music I knew would just fit really, really well with the movie. And when we cast Angie, part of her audition tape had these burlesque dancer. She's a burlesque dancer, classically trained burlesque dancer, actually. And she was like, I was like looking at these videos and was like, holy crap, like we can actually do something here with this scene. So I asked her if she'd be willing to, and she's like, absolutely. She completely choreographed that scene. And it was actually the first, I think one of the first things we shot on the first day. All afternoon we basically shot that whole dance scene. And she was the one, I basically had contacted Gunship and they had agreed to let us use their music. They were very into it. Kind of gave us carte blanche on that. And so I handed them to Kato and I was like, hey, listen, what would be a good track for you to basically do a dance to? And she picked Dark All Day, which made me absolutely thrilled. And it was so funny because we, you know, like any music video, basically you play it over and over and over again. And that song is long. It's like 5.5 minutes long. So the whole crew was like on set having to listen to Dark all day and nobody got sick and tired. I've actually had it playing on repeat
since watching the film. And I'm just like, oh yeah, I better download this for my road trip next week because I think I'm just going to be listening to the album again the whole entire time because there's so many great tracks on that album. But Dark all day is one of my favorites. And of course, it was the perfect title track for that record. But
yes,
it really blew me away. And the way that the music was used in that scene just sort of gave me chills a little bit. It just got me really excited for the rest of the film and to find out what was going to come.
Nice. Yeah.
And I know there's another Gunship track during the credits and the credits section of this film. I want to just make sure everyone knows. Keep watching it till the end. It is really, really cool. And you're going to see a lot more of the apocalypse.
Yes.
A lot of people had mentioned, oh, we don't really see a lot of what's happening outside with the apocalypse, but just keep watching. You don't want to miss anything. So
yeah. It was fun to kind of do that. We definitely knew that some people would get frustrated by that. And you know, we're making a bottle movie. It's made with the intention of only being, I mean, the movie is predominantly the point of view of Angie. So, and there's actually moments in the film where, we're trying to keep that point of view pretty clear. But Angie is stuck in a booth and, you know, can't see. But we really wanted to sort of like give something there. So the ending is very important, actually, I think, to sort of understanding half of the movie, really. Because I guess I like asking people, like, you know, what is the, you know, what do you think they're actually descending into? It's hard to sort of talk about it without feeling spoilery, but there's definitely some interesting things under the surface there.
Yeah. I think overall I could say there's no real escape for the decisions we've made. It's you can't change the past. You can only move forward and do your best to survive it. So I'll put it that way.
I love that. I love that.
But yeah, the film, I loved it. I did see a couple themes in there, whether intended or not. I felt very empowered by that whole dance sequence of
good.
Angie's. I was like, man, she's such a badass. And I really love the character. And even with Shayna, I feel like is such a strong character. It's hidden beneath this being a bit of a religious zealot, but it comes to life. She does come to life throughout the film and especially towards the end. So even though it is something that comes up at the end of the film, it's not something you might necessarily know, but it ties into the overall narrative. Were you planning for this to be a queer horror story going into it? How did that develop?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I think it actually became more queer over time as we were filming it, but because both Shayna and Kato are queer, and they brought a lot to that. But we definitely knew, you know, part of the point of putting it in the 80s was to sort of position the characters so that, you know, like Angie sort of, you know, who Angie is, this person who she's used to being on the defensive. She's used to being the person who's, you know, marginalized essentially. And you know, I grew up in the 80s, and I very specifically remember just this moment where for a long time you just didn't talk about homosexuality, like it just wasn't there, and then all of a sudden it's in the conversation, you know, like late 80s, something like that. And it's, you know, I remember the sort of the social stuff around that, sort of the culture and how it, you know, I mean, with AIDS and all that other stuff, it just became this thing, and how people reacted to that was very varied. And I knew people who had to sort of check themselves on it, you know, suddenly go, oh, wait, okay. Yeah, no, I have to, you know, this is a person. I have to check my prejudices. So, you know, we knew that that was an element to this. You know, on top of that too, just knowing how, I mean, I know people, I grew up with people in the church who were queer, but, you know, that is a very hard thing to do, to be, you know, to, I knew, I've known people who really hid that their whole life because their religion was such an important part of that. But it's also been amazing to me to see how almost all those people didn't stop being religious when they came out. It's just that their understanding of God and that changed to a more, I think, more accurate representation of what, you know, if you subscribe to the Bible, what it's actually saying, you know what I mean? So this is all kind of coming from, you know, from a lot of personal experience. Tim is the same way. He knew someone just like Sally. And we kind of wanted to tell that story a little bit, you know, and just how, you know, it's sad to see us. I don't want to get too overly political, but it is really hard right now, I think, to see that world that it felt like for a while was ancient history suddenly be drastically relevant again. You know, like there's this idea that we want to sort of showcase, oh, look at this time period, 1987, where, you know, this feels so far away and the ideas have changed. And then you kind of, here we are in 2022 and they're not that different really. And if anything, it's just as dangerous. So it was very important for us to tell the story, for sure.
Well, and tell me a little bit about Shudder acquiring the film. What was that like for you? It's your feature length debut.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Shudder is awesome. As horror fans, we're like, oh my God, I love Shudder, right?
So, yes.
Yeah. What was that experience like?
It was huge because, like, we knew this doesn't have any stars in it. It doesn't have, you know, I mean, I would say probably our biggest star would be like Tim and Mike, you know, as comic writers. But even then, you know, there's no guarantee that horror fans or movie fans know who they are necessarily. So, you know, we were making a very specific horror film, a very, you know, like very unique horror films, you know, with this high concept. And the idea of Shudder coming on, that was like early on, we were like, this would be great for Shudder because their audience is just so accepting of this kind of movie. Like a good portion of their audience, which I think is just an incredible community. I'm on the Reddit for Shudder. I'm on the Discord. I've been a subscriber since it started. Tim is the same. So we feel integrated into this community, and I think there's nothing else like it. And just, I love seeing the stuff that Shudder promotes. Like I can't imagine anywhere else that you would see something like, say, Blood Machines. You know what I mean? So we knew, like for us, it was like, yes, this has to be the home for this movie. Like, we just feel like these are the kinds of people that would understand what we're trying to do here. And I feel like that's definitely, I'm seeing the responses, and I feel like that's vindicated. It's definitely been the case. So they came on board last summer, basically, because one of our producers, Aaron B. Kuntz of Scare Package and Paper Street Pictures, has a really strong relationship with them, and kind of gave them the film, and they loved it right away. They made an immediate offer, and we took it because we just knew that this was the right home. We all just, it was kind of an instant thing. We just knew that it was good. So, and it just, as a long time Shudder fanatic, just someone who just really just loves their curation, and the fact that they curate and the fact that they build actual community with their subscribers, it was just a huge, huge honor.
You went through the festival experience. Kato won Best Actress for one of the festivals. And so what, had you been to festivals before to promote a film, even a short film? What was that like?
I have, yeah. I had a short film in 2016, I think, called The Pooka, with Chris Sullivan of This Is Us fame. And it actually played at Palm Springs International. It had a really healthy festival life, and at a time too before the pandemic, so it was much easier to travel to all that. So I kind of experienced festival life with that. And this one, you know, the post on this film took a long time, because we initially, the idea was for all of the effects to be practical. And when we kind of got it back, you know, because we just didn't have a long schedule, because our budget was so small, it meant we didn't have a lot of shooting days. And special effects in movies take up days, you know. So we struggled a little bit initially with trying to get everything where we wanted it. So we started to pursue VFX, augmenting with CG and stuff like that. And some really brilliant people came on board to help us do that. But it really kind of pushed our post schedule really far. We really were hoping, our plan was to get this into the festivals around 2021. And it just sort of like the post schedule kept moving and moving because VFX, you know, just the end credit scene alone, that took months. So unfortunately we didn't get as long of a festival run as we wanted, but, you know, knowing so early that we were going to be on Shudder, you know, definitely helped us sort of like not worry about that. We were really, really, I mean, absolutely thrilled to make our premiere at Panic Fest, and our world premiere was at Fanespoa in Brazil, like literally like the week before that. So, I mean, we still kind of had some really amazing responses there, but, you know, we also knew that, you know, we're just excited to sort of get this in front of people. You know, the hardest thing of everything was just sort of holding still. It was weird. Just a little diversion. This was a weird movie in the sense that it started out as a secret because we were hoping that it would come out in 21. We shot it in summer of 20. And so we didn't say anything. We just kept holding back and holding back. And so me, Tim and Mike, the whole crew, everybody, we had to just basically stay quiet about the movie for like 2 years, because then Shudder came on board early, but their whole marketing scheme is that they tend to announce things post release.
A month. And even with screeners, I got it about a month ago.
Yep.
So I watched it. And I wanted to watch it at Panic Fest, but I was virtual. Didn't get an opportunity, but yeah. So then when I'm like, oh great, I get the screener because it's Shudder. So I had an opportunity to watch it, and then I watched it again on release day that morning. So,
oh nice.
Just to make sure that, you know, my review had everything in it that I wanted it to.
Nice.
But yeah, I mean, yeah, they hold things pretty close to the cuff until. Yeah. And I think a lot of that is about generating excitement. And they do it so well.
Yeah, it works. I mean, it's hard. It's hard when you're just so excited about it. But, you know, we were all cool with it because we knew, you know, I've seen how it works with other films. You know, in the streaming days, marketing is different. I mean, when someone hears about a movie online, they want to know how soon they can see it. So, you know, it makes perfect sense. And we're totally cool with it. It just was, you know, the waiting period was just, it was torture.
I want to ask you about any other projects that you have going on. What can you tell us? If you can't tell us anything, that's okay. What nuggets of information can you share?
We've got a few things. I mean, there's a lot of stuff in the works, you know, and it's nothing I can't say yet. I'm trying to think. So we've got, me, Tim and Mike are actually writing a horror comic, and we're hoping to get that out by 2023. So hopefully once we kind of figure out the schedule on that, an announcement will be coming on that. And I'm very, very excited. It's a really, really cool idea. And I think people are gonna absolutely love it. And of course it's Michael Morisi and Tim Seeley, so you know it's going to be very interesting.
It's going to be good.
so that's a big thing. Obviously, we're still working on Revival, and we hope to have a really big announcement about that very soon. But can't quite say anything about that yet. And yeah, we're just sort of trying to navigate what the next film might be. I mean, we got a few options, you know, and trying to decide kind of what the best route to go there is. But we're all pretty busy, and hope to keep working. But yeah, right now we're kind of just sort of enjoying seeing how Revealer is sort of how it's kind of finding its audience, which we kind of knew it would. You know, we want everyone to like it, but we knew that this movie is very, it's a specific kind of movie. And it's really kind of fun to see, you know, to see it find its audience specifically.
Luke, it has been an absolute pleasure to have you here. Thank you so much. I think that Revealer has become one of my new favorite films already. I really expected no less from a script that Tim was involved with. So,
oh, thank you. No, I really appreciate it. I mean, it's really exciting to see people understand, you know, what we're trying to do with this movie, and it is very personal, and I love it. So I'm just happy to talk about it. I'll talk about it with anybody. So I appreciate you taking the time to ask me questions. This has been awesome. And thank you again for the review. It was incredible. So,
oh, thank you so much. I was actually very flattered when I saw your tweet. So yeah, I mean, you guys are, I mean, any of you are welcome back anytime.
Awesome.
Did you enjoy that episode? If you like the podcast, we encourage you to head over to Podchaser and leave us a review. The best part is it helps put Slay Away in the hands of more horror fans.